Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm an Assistant Director of Networks with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host a Courthouse Steps oral argument on Olivier v. City of Brandon, featuring Nate Kellum. Nate is Senior Counsel for First Liberty Institute. Prior to coming to First Liberty, Nate was the founder and chief counsel of the Center for Religious Expression. For over three decades, Nate has defended religious liberty in courtrooms across the country. He has handled more than 500 litigated cases and 50 appeals before various federal appellate courts, winning numerous landmark decisions. Our moderator today is Stephen Burnett. Stephen is an instructional fellow at the Harvard Law School Religious Freedom Clinic. Before joining the clinic, he clerked in his hometown, San Diego, California, for the Honorable Patrick Bumate, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. He received his JD from Stanford Law School. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, thank you both for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Thanks, Marco, for the introduction, and thank you, Nate, for being here with me.
As Marco said,
we're going to talk about the oral argument that happened last week in the case of Olivier versus City of Brandon, Mississippi. Just a little bit of background about this case. Gabrielle Olivier is a Christian who feels called to share the gospel with his fellow citizens through street preaching. And Olivier visited the amphitheater in the city of Brandon, Mississippi, about five or six times before the city passed an ordinance restricting protests and demonstrations near the amphitheater to a designated area in the hours surrounding any live events at the amphitheater. 2 years later, Olivier visited the amphitheater and was told to go to the protest area, but the protest area was too isolated for attendees to hear his street preaching, so he returned to the sidewalk where he had been before. He was eventually arrested, fined, and released for violating the ordinance, and then he brought a Section 1983 suit under the First and 14th Amendments to declare the ordinance unconstitutional and enjoin its enforcement against him in the future. His claim was not successful. The Fifth Circuit applied the Supreme Court's decision in Heck v. Humphrey, which held that Olivier's prior conviction barred his Section 1983 suit because even prospective relief would necessarily undermine his prior conviction. So the Fifth Circuit ruled against him, and then it denied rehearing en banc by only one vote over three separate dissents. So Olivier petitioned for certiorari, which was granted, and the court granted certiorari to answer two questions. The first, whether, as the Fifth Circuit holds, in conflict with the Ninth and Tenth Circuits, the Supreme Court's decision in Heck v. Humphrey bars Section 1983 claims seeking purely prospective relief where the plaintiff has been punished before under the law challenged as unconstitutional. And the second question is whether, as the Fifth Circuit and at least four others hold, in conflict with the five other circuits, Heck v. Humphrey bars Section 1983 claims by plaintiffs, even where they never had access to federal habeas relief. So oral argument was heard last week on December 3rd, lasted about an hour and a half, and Nate was sitting a few feet away from the Supreme Court justices at counsel's table, as I understand. So Nate, maybe you can tell us what was your overall reaction? What do you make of the questions that the justices asked?
Yeah, Stephen, thanks for that introduction. Yeah, it's a fascinating thing. It's a humbling thing. Very exciting to be in the Supreme Court. There's really nothing quite like it. And this particular argument, I was impressed by how engaged the justices were, how interested that was reflected in their questioning. And actually, the questioning went long. You mentioned that it went hour and a half. It's supposed to go like an hour. And so I think they were very interested in these issues that were presented. And it'll be interesting to see what happens. We don't know what will happen at this point. Obviously, Stevenson's just the argument has taken place. And because the justices, they speak through their opinions. They don't really speak through their questions. But I will say that I thought the questioning certainly gave us room for optimism that perhaps they will reverse and allow for Mr. Olivier to go forward with his case.
Care to make any predictions as to how the votes will come down?
Well, you're definitely putting me on the spot, Stephen. I'm not sure I can go that far. I will say this. It seemed like there was a consensus with the court that there was something wrong here. The idea that Mr. Olivier or any other plaintiff could be forever barred from bringing a 1983 claim challenging an unconstitutional ordinance just because that person was charged and paid a fine under the ordinance previously. So I think a lot of the justices voiced concern about that. I think they found some of the arguments of the city incredulous and supported that. But there did seem to be a struggle as far as what the implications would be. If they were to rule in favor of Mr. Olivier, what would that look like?
Mm-hmm. Maybe we should take a step back for a minute. I think a lot of people who aren't familiar with this area of law might be thinking, if you're convicted of something under for violating an unconstitutional ordinance or statute, why would there be a judicial rule barring you from seeking relief from a court in the future, regardless of whether or not that invalidates your past conviction if the conviction was under an unconstitutional law? So maybe you can just describe what the heck bar is and why we have it.
Sure. Well, as the name would suggest, it came from a case, Heck v. Humphrey, that was rendered in 1994. And the context of that is it was a prisoner who was concerned about the criminal process, what happened in his trial. He believed that there was some evidence that was entered that should not have been entered, that there was some evidence that he would have loved to have seen come in that he thinks could have led to a different result had it been allowed to enter. And so he was bringing a lawsuit, a 1983 claim in federal court against the prosecutor and also some other officials for damages, saying that this had gone wrong and that he was entitled to damages. And Justice Scalia authored the Heck opinion, and what he said in it is that it said, well, your claim of relief is really not in 1983. That's not really the vehicle for this type of action. Rather, you have access to federal habeas corpus, which is another federal statute that specifically allows for prisoners to challenge the criminal process. And so that it was really a matter of jurisdiction. The court held that there really wasn't jurisdiction for a 1983 claim because this plaintiff in Heck actually had access through federal habeas corpus. And so that was the ruling there. And the question before the court is can that principle, can that doctrine be applied to someone like Mr. Olivier, who was never incarcerated, and the nature of his relief was future looking. It was prospective relief. So he wasn't trying to revisit what happened in a criminal process. He wasn't trying to overturn a conviction. Rather, he wanted to go back out and speak. He wanted to go back out and preach. But this law just hung over his head, and it kept him from doing it. It prevented him from doing it, and it really served as a forever bar.
So the HEC bar was, I think, as the justices put it, a way to prevent inmates from making an end run around habeas with a 1983 suit. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And that seemed to be the idea behind it, that I think there was a concern that there could be just a flood of 1983 actions brought by prisoners and have a lot of prisoner litigation where they are challenging individuals that were involved in a criminal process and essentially trying to overturn a conviction through a 1983 suit. And that's what seemed to be the underlying reasons behind the Hague decision and the progeny.
Right. But in Olivier's case, habeas relief was not available to him. Is that correct?
That's correct, because he was never incarcerated. He wasn't in custody, so he didn't have access to it. And that was our second question. That was question number two, is can the Hague bar apply to someone who never had access to habeas? And then the first question dealt with the prospective relief. And it seemed like the justices, actually, they addressed both questions. Stephen, it seemed like they were more interested in the first, and that was the prospective relief.
Mm-hmm. Staying on the subject of habeas for a second, one of the questions that I thought was interesting, though maybe not relevant legally, was asked near the beginning, and it had to do with the parole conditions that still affect Olivier. Could you explain a little bit what those parole conditions are and, what your take on that question was?
Sure. I think that's where the justices were trying to determine how the opinion should read. If the justices were to rule in Mr. Olivier's favor, what would be the boundaries of that? Because I think there's a concern here. What about if an individual who is on parole and they're seeking injunctive relief, prospective relief, that would come before the parole term had ended. That was not the case with Mr. Olivier, that by the time there was a short probationary period, but that period had concluded by the time there was a ruling. So that really was not relevant for Mr. Olivier's particular case. But of course, at the Supreme Court level, they have to consider all scenarios, all circumstances. And one circumstance they were concerned about is what if that wasn't the case? What if the parole had lasted longer, and that your prospective relief, would that have the effect of undermining the ongoing parole? The way that we address that is that really shouldn't matter, because we're focusing in on prospective relief. We're not trying to do anything with the conviction or the parole, for that matter. And so to get that parole suspended, that would require additional steps. You'd have to go back to the state court, and it may or may not be granted. But still, I think it certainly is important to note that several justices were wrestling with that issue, that hypothetical, that if a parole was continuing or if a person was in prison and they were seeking prospective relief, should it apply?
Right. And I think there was even some difference that I heard in terms of how the two of the oral argument advocates approached that question. Just maybe for those who weren't listening to the oral argument, there were actually three advocates. Allison Ho from Gibson and Dunn was representing Olivier. And then as amicus curiae, we had the United States, Ashley Robertson, assistant to the Solicitor General. And then for respondents, Todd Butler from Mississippi. So could you speak a little bit about the difference, the subtle difference between Ms. Robertson and Ms. Ho in terms of how they thought about the parole conditions and the potential effect that could have on the HEC bar?
Sure. Generally speaking, the Solicitor General's office was supportive of the petitioner, Ms. Ho, and the rest of our team on the first question. However, she did have a caveat, and that was this particular hypothetical that was raised by several of the justices. And what if the person is on parole and the probation is still on? What if the person is in prison? What should be done there? And that's where where the Solicitor General, I believe, was trying to split the baby and really come in between the two parties and say that in that instance, heck, Barr should apply. And so that was the position of the government here, is that generally speaking, if a petitioner is seeking prospective relief, heck really has no application. It should not bar a plaintiff pursuing a 1983 claim. But if that person is in custody, then heck should apply. Mm-hmm.
And what about the question? I think it was Justice Gorsuch who asked, what do we do with the fact that Olivia did bring a claim for damages initially that was dropped, I believe, at the Fifth Circuit.
Yes, that Justice Gorsuch did bring that up, and that was true, that in a sense that initially a damages claim was brought in the complaint, but as pointed out by our counsel, it was dropped by the time it reached the Fifth Circuit, and so I really don't believe that is a point that will weigh one way or another, because damages claim was not sought. But that could be a separate question there. Again, just thinking hypothetically, what if the damages claim was not brought? Should that affect the ruling? And I'm not sure the justices were of the same mind on that question.
I'm not sure of that either. One other question that kept reoccurring throughout the oral argument was Justice Thomas's question about what do we do about the fact that there wasn't just Olivier protesting or preaching here. There were other people who were preaching who were not given the conviction that Olivier received. Now those other people who are, you know, involved in the same conduct and seeking the same relief, they're allowed to bring a claim for prospective relief that Olivier is not allowed to bring. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that was a question that was recurring. It is recurring in a sense that in addition to Justice Thomas, several others brought up that same scenario. And it really echoed some concerns that was raised by Judge Oldman in that you mentioned earlier, Stephen, that at the Fifth Circuit, we petitioned for en banc, and that en banc denial had three dissenters, one of whom was Judge Oldman. And Judge Oldman brought up this scenario. Well, if you can have a person doing the exact same thing, and in fact, in this case, we did, someone who's also violating an ordinance, which we believe to be unconstitutional, and one, Mr. Olivier, he was arrested and he was convicted. And then the other was warned and said, okay, if you don't leave, if you don't stop, then you will be arrested. And so the way it's turned out is that the second person, and here there's a companion case, Siders versus City of Brandon, she was able to go forward with that. Heck is no bar to her. And yet for Mr. Olivier, it is. And so it was something that was raised by Judge Oldman initially, and then several of the justices during oral argument. In fact, Justice Thomas asked every counsel that same question. He asked that of Ms. Ho, he asked that of the Solicitor General's office, and he also asked that of Mr. Butler, really pointing out this irony. How can that be? How can that be where you have two people doing the same thing, and yet one can bring a 1983 claim and the other one cannot?
Yeah, it is a very strange situation to be in. And as I understand it, First Liberty is defending the other street preacher, Siders. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct. And so that case is ongoing. It is actually subject to a stay pending the outcome of this decision.
Okay, interesting. I think I understand there was at one point in the oral argument, I think it was Justice Jackson said that the plaintiff in that case, in the Siders case, had lost on the merits. Would you like to correct the record on that?
Yeah, that's not quite correct. There was a loss, but it's a loss on a motion for a preliminary injunction in which she lost at the district court level. That was appealed to the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit affirmed. But there's also a petition for an en banc there, and there's some dissents from it. Really, giving somewhat of a roadmap as to how this case could successfully be pursued on final. So because it was preliminary in nature, that's really not something that we could say she's lost, at least not yet.
Right. And in terms of where you draw the line, making prospective relief available, you know, for one party versus another party, or for some claims versus others, what do you think of the line that the respondent's attorney was attempting to argue for, you know, between as applied and facial challenges? Do you think that that would be a sensible approach to when you would be heck barred or not?
Yeah, in my view, I don't believe that that argument carried much weight. No justice followed up on that. It didn't seem to make the point that there would be a legal basis for that distinction. And also, just as a matter of record, Mr. Olivier brought an as-applied and as well as a facial challenge anyway. So in this particular case, it was not relevant. And I'm not sure that justices would consider that to be a pertinent issue anyhow.
So we were discussing the three separate opinions that were filed in the denial of rehearing en banc in the Fifth Circuit. The first of those three separate opinions, I believe, from Judge Richman, I believe.
That's correct.
Was discussing, it essentially made the point that we already have preclusion doctrine. You know, why isn't this analysis really, shouldn't that just be a preclusion issue? What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, that was a question I was posed to my co-counsel, Allison Ho, about that very thing. I believe it was Justice Kavanaugh that raised it. And the answer to that is that as a matter of Mississippi law, which in the state law would control this, that issue preclusion is really not an issue here. But regardless, and I believe Justice Kavanaugh acknowledged this, is that it would have to be remanded anyhow. So that's all we're seeking here, is a remand is something that the lower court can consider.
Right. And could you maybe just talk a little bit about why Olivia didn't challenge his initial conviction, you know, and try to enjoin the law in that same action, potentially avoiding heck bar issues?
He had other counsel at that matter, so I can't speak definitively as to that. But just from speaking with Mr. Olivier about this, he really just wanted to get that over with. The best thing that could happen in a municipal court, or if you go up the state court system, is that you be found not guilty. You still don't have any relief from a law that's still on the books. And so what his predominant concern was is to be able to speak without fear of arrest. And so he wanted to go back out there, and he viewed, and I believe correctly so, that the most direct way, and really the only way he could do that, is through the federal form, is to file a 1983 action in federal court in order to challenge this law and to enjoin it, so it would not apply to him.
Mm-hmm. Right. So he wanted a federal relief that was provided by federal statute. And in federal court, there's actually some judicial doctrines that prevent you from addressing or revisiting your state convictions. Isn't that right?
That's right. And a couple of justices pointed that out. It just seemed like that, because there's all types of rules where you cannot challenge it while the state proceedings are still ongoing. You can't challenge it after there's been a conclusion at the state court level. And so it seemed to point to the obvious conclusion that you would reach from the city's argument. That is, when can you bring this lawsuit? When is it available to you? And the answer is never. And so I think very telling when the justices forced that conclusion, because that seemed to be the argument, is that there is no circumstance in which Mr. Olivier could bring his claim.
Mm-hmm. And what did you make of some of the questioning later on in the oral argument about whether or not prisoners would ever be able to bring suits or actions addressing violations of their religious rights in prison?
Yeah, that was similar to the parole question about probation. If someone is in prison, and instead of trying to revisit what happened in the criminal process, or not trying to challenge that or the conviction, rather they believe that law is unconstitutional and they want to challenge that. They want to seek a declaration and some type of an injunction against this enforcement. And the question there is, okay, so should Heck Bar apply? And our position is that it should not, as long as the relief that's being sought is purely prospective in nature. That's not really affecting the element of the underlying conviction, but really it's future looking and is focused on the underlying law itself. And that's where I believe the Solicitor General indicated a different approach. And that is she would say that that in that scenario, the Heck Bar should apply if someone is in custody, because that puts it back again in the core of habeas, that perhaps habeas is the way, the route in which the prisoner should take that.
Mm-hmm. And just to clarify, the petitioner's view is that the line should be drawn at prospective versus not prospective, regardless of incarceration.
You know, there are some questions about that, Stephen. Yeah, it would be regardless of incarceration, but also there are some questions about, and Justice Alito rather pointedly was asking my co-counsel, should it apply to all prospective relief? And so while generally so, I do think an important distinction to draw here is that would not apply to a claim for prospective relief that seeks to reverse something that happened. So if it seems to be prospective relief, technically prospective relief in name, but really you're trying to do something about what has already happened to you, you're trying to revisit the past, then that type of prospective relief should be Heck Barred.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the precedents in the Fifth Circuit and from the Supreme Court, they kind of use, you know, a bunch of different phrases to describe the situations that the Heck Bar applies. I've seen, you know, invalidated a prior conviction or calls into question. Has the doctrine sort of expanded over time?
There's a lot of discussion about that at the oral argument, where while there was, I believe, at least my perception of it, Stephen, is that there was somewhat of a consensus that something is wrong here, that a person like Mr. Olivier, who wants to challenge the law, should be able to proceed with a 1983 suit. One of the troubling things, I believe, for many of the justices was some language in Heck itself, and that was if the claim would, and this is verbiage from the opinion, if it would necessarily imply the invalidity of the conviction. Extremely broad language, and certainly from a metaphysical view of it, a somewhat loose view of that, that would seem to indicate that yes, if a law is declared unconstitutional, it could cast some doubt as to whether or not the conviction was valid in the first place. And so that seemed to go against the grain of some follow-up cases that would seem to necessarily imply the invalidity, but the Heck Bar was not applied. And that was our argument, is that the court has essentially interpreted this phrase with its subsequent cases. Mm-hmm. But I think that's something that the court, the justices were grappling with as far as exactly what should we do with that. A couple of justices suggested that maybe we should do away with that language altogether, that we should backtrack on that language. I think others would probably be more interested in some type of gloss in interpreting it, and maybe some would like to keep it as is. I think that's one of the things, interesting things we'll see that'll be developed in the opinion when we receive it.
Yeah, it's an interesting question because, you know, like we were talking about earlier, the companion protester, if they were successful in their suit, that would also call into question Olivier's prior conviction, even though there would be no Heck Bar issue there. And so that seems just a little bit strange.
It does seem strange, and that was not lost on many of the justices.
Mm-hmm. I should just pause to mention, for the viewers of the program, please feel free to submit your questions at any time. You can submit them through the chat. and we'll make sure to, we'll try to address as many of them as we can. We have actually a question now that we can turn to from Carl Olson, and he asks, what was Alito's comment about a writ of error quorum nobis?
I think I do remember that. I'm not sure I quite followed that, Stephen. Justice Alito was pointing out several things, and he was actually, one of the more difficult questioners for our side of it. And I think what he was trying to get at is a situation where you have a challenge to the law, and yet it could have some type of indirect effect on perhaps some collateral attendant things that could be associated with it, such as possession of firearm or something of that nature. And so I think there was some concern about sort of lingering effects or maybe even unintended effects, regardless of what the plaintiff has in mind, that could affect the original conviction and how the court is to deal with that.
Gotcha. And I'm not very, my Latin is very rusty, but I should have mentioned that the questioner also said they think quorum nobis is habeas based on new evidence.
Along that line is that, if there is new evidence in the matter. And so should that have an effect? And so that, I think that seemed to be the question is, and Justice Alito seemed very concerned about it, is that this is definitely one of the major driving forces behind the Hague decision in the first place. And that is respect of the state court judgment, the comedy there of not having the federal court stepping on the toes of the state criminal court. That we need to make sure that is respected, and that there's going to be any change, it should not be done flippantly. Mm-hmm.
So you were representing Olivier in this case. How many years have you been working with him, and what is he like as a person?
I received a call from him in early summer of 2021, where he told me about this situation that happened to him, where, and as you described in the introduction, Stephen, about this ordinance that would essentially put him in literally a box. It was a painted off box that would be 100 yards away from any meaningful pedestrian traffic. And that seemed to be the whole idea, to really separate him from his would-be audience, such that they could not hear his message if he was preaching, or if he was holding a sign, they could not see the message. And that was certainly troubling for him. And that's why he strayed away from the area and was arrested and convicted for violating this ordinance. And so that's really kind of been the situation that we dealt with when we pursued this claim in that same year of 2021. And so we've just gone through this process. But through it, Stephen, I've gotten to know Mr. Olivier fairly well. I think there's probably connotations or maybe presumptions that people could have about folks who would self-describe as street preachers, thinking maybe they're loud or crazy or obnoxious, and there certainly could be some things where someone might think that about Mr. Olivier, but he's actually a very rational guy. He's only seeking the freedom to be able to share his beliefs. I mean, that's really a bottom line for him. And he has a pretty ordinary life. He co-pastors a church, but his main job, he's a landscaper. And so during the winter, he's collecting leaves and bagging them. During the summer, he's mowing lawns along with others. And then he's got five children, and so he's a busy man. But being able to share his religious beliefs is a priority for him, and he wants to do it. And he wants to be able to do it at that park without the ordinance restricting him.
Yeah, and I remember, if I'm remembering correctly from the, I think some of the lower court decisions, it was alleged that the designated protest area, I think was, it was 200 feet away or something like that. And the ordinance said that you had to be only audible within 100 feet or something like that. I might have gotten those numbers wrong, but
no, you're pretty close there, Stephen. It is 284 feet, so it's almost it's almost 100 yards, and but they also had restrictions. They put you in a zone by labeling him a protester, even though he wasn't protesting anything or had any intention of protesting anything. They put him in this protest zone that's about 100 yards away. But then within it, there's several other restrictions, including that he could only hold his sign up so high to affect the readability of it. And then also as far as his speech, while he could use an amplifier within that zone, just as you noted, only that can be heard 100 feet away. So they put him in an area where he could not possibly reach his audience.
Right. And when Mr. Olivier street preaches, is he usually, you know, is he combative? Is he obstructing people? Is there, you know, is there violence that frequently accompanies his activity, or is it peaceful generally?
It's peaceful. There are certainly times when even his peaceful speech is there could be a more hateful response to it. And over the years, he's learned how to deal with that and try to remain calm when perhaps others are not. But generally speaking, there's really no issues. There's no real interactions. He's just trying to get his point across. He's trying to convey his beliefs, really for people to accept it for whatever they deem it worth. So he's not trying to stop anybody. He's not trying to force any literature on anyone. If someone doesn't want to accept the literature, they can just keep walking. If they don't want to have a conversation with them, they can just keep walking. But he wants to be available in case someone does.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think this is something that that comes up in the analysis of his compatriot's case, of Springsider's case. And there's one of the precedents cited by the court, even though the preliminary injunction was denied, makes the point that speech can't be assessed based on people's reactions to the speech, especially if their reaction includes illegal conduct that can be put on the speaker.
No, that's exactly right. And that's a very important point and very important doctrine, really, for free speech. And that goes into a heckler's veto. This idea that the only speech that's allowed is that is generally acceptable. Really, if that was the case, you wouldn't need a First Amendment. The First Amendment is for speech that perhaps people do have disagreement. But you can't allow someone who's either hostile or violent toward the speech to be able to dictate whether the speech can be uttered or not.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, many of the protections for free expression, for speech, freedom to exercise your religion, many of those were won by members of faiths that do regularly practice street preaching. And some of the work that I did for this case looked at the history of street preaching, and I saw that it was, in fact, very deeply woven into the fabric of American religious life all the way back to the colonies, and played a very large role in the development of, you know, American faith and also our legal system and our protections. And so that was very interesting.
Yeah, and it's critical, right, Stephen, because here it involves religion and certainly what you're referencing in Amicus Brief, that was the focus of it, is religious speech, which is certainly a very important aspect of our country. But also it's broader than that. There's this idea that if we have something to say as citizens, we can go to certain areas. We can go to public parks, we can go to public sidewalks, and we can share those views with our neighbor. Because that is the place that we can do it. That was true in the founding of our country, and that's still true today. That is a place that should be recognized where all views are welcome. We may disagree with it, and we may not like it, but we have to respect it, because every person has a right to free speech.
All right, we've got a few questions coming in. Let me just pull this open. So we've got a question from John Scheller. He asks if Olivier would receive this benefit of the outcome of any other plaintiff's similar claim, what practical reason would he have to pursue his own personal claim?
Sure. Well, I'll tell you, that was one that I think would always be important from an injunctive relief standpoint, but I think it'd be even much more so following the Trump versus Casa decision, where that's become obvious that now you can only obtain relief for yourself. And so while someone else may can obtain relief for them, then Mr. Olivier needs to obtain his own.
Next, we've got a question from Rod Sullivan, who asks, can you tell us more about the physical description of the protest zone? We did a little bit of this, but we can still go into more detail. Was there any audience near the zone, and were there any other protesters using it and competing with him?
Yeah. Probably good to put this in context about what happened with Mr. Olivier. So when he goes to the park, and this, you've mentioned how he is able to go there several times before, and then, but there was a lapse in time, and that's because that was during COVID. And so you had the restrictions where I believe the park was closed, but definitely the amphitheater, and they had closed down events for at least a year and a half. And so, and then in May of 2021, it was the reopening. And so in that interim, that's when they passed the ordinance. And so Mr. Olivier goes out there with his family and a few friends. And as soon as he parks, the chief of police shows up and says, hey, we have a special spot for you. And that was his words. We have a special spot for you. And Mr. Olivier didn't know exactly what to think of that, but he decided to check it out. And so he walks, and he assumes it's going to be close to where he had gone before, but it wasn't. And then they had a trouble finding it at first. But then as we talked about earlier, that's because it was some 100 yards away. So then he walks 100 yards away from the, where the pedestrian traffic would be. And, it's a box that's painted. It's, I believe it's about 10 by 8. So it's not that big of a space. And so that basically they're to stand in there, stay in there. And that's the only place where they can speak. And so there is some, it's by a parking lot, but unless it's a huge event, no one will even be parking, close to them. And so they were put in a spot where they really could not reach anybody with their message. They couldn't have a conversation. They couldn't hand out literature, and even such where they're using an amplifier, they stick to that 100-foot rule. They couldn't be heard. And if they had signs, they had to have it lowered such that they could not be read.
And I think I remember also reading that there might have been a hill in between where this designated zone was and the sidewalk. And I also thought it was noteworthy that this zone was not on a sidewalk. I believe it was sort of off to the side. It wasn't something that you would pass necessarily going through where people were going into the amphitheater.
No, that's exactly right. And that is significant, because it's not where people would be expected to walk. And certainly no one did. Different ways, different routes in which someone could walk to the amphitheater from where they're parking, but none of them would be close to where they were standing.
And is the area where they were standing initially before the police moved them, was that a road that went only into the amphitheater, or was this a public sidewalk that also went into other parts of the city?
It was a public sidewalk that went to other parts of the park, and what they did is they stood off to the side, just as a matter of how Mr. Olivier wanted to do it. He didn't want to cause trouble. He really did not want to encounter issues with the police, and so he really made a a conscious effort not to be in the way. So he stood off to the side where the sidewalk would remain free. That's where he wanted to go, but he was not allowed to be there.
I see. And this isn't relevant to anything other than my curiosity, but do you know what was playing at the Life Amphitheater?
Is Lee Bryce. He's a country artist. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, Stephen. It was their first concert, so they had somewhat of a crowd, but not really that big of a crowd. But they certainly had enough where it offered for Mr. Olivier a potential audience, folks that could hear his message, but he was deprived of it.
Mm-hmm. And sounds like he wouldn't be, you know, drowning out the actual speaker by any means.
Yes. No, not by any means. Just because of the sheer distance, and also because of the volume, of course. And if it was, that would be something that could be certainly dealt with. If your volume is such where it is causing an issue, where it's reaching a certain level which is considered disturbing, you can definitely deal with the volume. Regrettably, that was not the approach of the city, but rather it was to put them in a place where they could not reach an audience.
Back to the questions. We have another question from an anonymous attendee. Did the court ever consider the truth of the gospel and the fact that communicators of the gospel will be hated and thus should be protected? That is, did the court ever consider why it is that the gospel is hated and the motivations to suppress it? Is there a factual record? And I would, you know, I'll let you respond, but I would say, you know, the oral argument at least largely did not focus on any of the aspects or characteristics of the belief. But I think that I would imagine, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think any of the parties involved exhibited a particularly anti-Christian bias, but I could be wrong on that. What do you think?
Well, I certainly believe, the first part of what you were saying, Stephen, is undoubtedly correct. It's just something that the court didn't reach, and that's been really a large part of the struggle here. Is we're 4 years into it, and at this point, we're just seeking an entry. We just want to be able to get into court and to be able to consider these issues. However, as part of their briefing, particularly in response to our motion for a preliminary injunction, the city indicated that there is an issue with the content of the speech. They quarreled with the content of the speech. And so that's something that really didn't get fleshed out very much because the Hague Bar applied. And so it really, we didn't even get to the merits. We didn't get to, is this speech protected? If so, what kind of restrictions can you have on this speech? Is this particular regulation, is it unconstitutional? These are all important questions, but none of them have been considered thus far. And that's what we hope to gain from this opinion, is that we'll be allowed to have our day in court. So the court will consider these very important questions. Mm-hmm.
So it could be, you know, another 4 to 5 years before you obtain an ultimate decision on the merits in this case. Is that right?
Well, I hope not, but that's certainly possible. We'll have to see. We would expect an opinion out sometime late spring, early summer, I would think, Stephen. We'll see what happens, and then if we are blessed with a favorable opinion, then at that point, yes, we will pursue a relief in court, and hopefully we'll be able to get that in short order, so Mr. Olivier can get back to that park some at a reasonable distance from the amphitheater and be able to share his views.
Mm-hmm. And just returning for a quick minute to the prior question, what does the ordinance actually prohibit? I think this language, protesting, counseling, and demonstrating, or something like that.
It's protesting and demonstrating. There's okay. No definitions that are supplied in it, Stephen. And another interesting aspect of this is that before the ordinance was even passed, they referred to Mr. Olivier as a protester, even though he really wasn't engaged in that type of activity. He's not right. Not contesting anything that's happening inside the amphitheater. He's not questioning anything that the city is doing. Rather, he's trying to share a religious message.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder, do you get the sense that the ordinance had anything to do with his activity?
Well, I think there, I do believe it has something to do with his activity. Now, there could have been some others. The record doesn't show that there's anyone else who had been out there and conducted anything like this. So even though the ordinance does not specify them directly, it refers to protesters, even, and they had called them protesters before. And so, and also there's been some affidavits that were submitted along with the argument at the motion for a preliminary injunction that indicated that, yes, they had some issues with this speech, and they were trying to address it with this ordinance.
Last question. In the amicus brief that I wrote with the help of the students at Harvard Law School for this case, we were representing four street preachers from around the country, and it seemed like all of them had dealt with ordinances that were somewhat similar to the one in question that Olivier was convicted of violating. Not all of those four street preachers that we worked with had the means or the resources to defend themselves, legally speaking, against those violations or those ordinances. So this, it seems like this is something that might be somewhat widespread on a local level around the country. Do you have any advice for any localities, city government trying to pass some ordinance balancing the concerns of the, traffic safety, road safety, freedom of movement of the citizens, and balancing that against the rights of potential street preachers or demonstrators or anyone seeking to spread their message, whatever that may be?
Yeah, it's a prevalent concern, and it certainly is prominent with individuals who are sharing religious beliefs or are trying to evangelize. But it is significantly broader and can involve all different types of speech, different types of ideologies, where again, if folks have something to say, they want to be able to go to public places and be able to say those things. And that's really what's at stake here with these types of laws. And you do see them where instead of just having a blanket ban where they say you cannot speak, they'll say, well, you can speak, but you have to speak in this other place, which achieves the same result. And that is, it keeps individuals from being able to communicate with those which they want to speak. And so those issues are definitely around for sure, and certainly you could see if there are legitimate issues, there could be reasons why a municipality would be concerned about it. If you had whether it be a group of protesters, actual protesters, or you had individuals like Mr. Olivier who are trying to evangelize, and they're standing in the way, they're keeping patrons from being able to enter. That's an issue, and then they should be able to tell those individuals, well, you have to get off the public sidewalk. You have to be able to leave them enough room to be able to get to where they're going. The issue here is they just went much further. They told them, no, you have to get 100 yards away, which obviously is taking something that really should have a scalpel, and they took an axe to it. And that I think that raises constitutional concerns. Or if they're causing too much noise, you could say, well, we have a DBA level of this. If you exceed that level, then we're going to have an issue. And instead of putting them in a place where they cannot be heard. And so I think as long as you just take a common sense, reasonable approach where you legitimately and proportionally deal with the issues, or whether it would be blocking, whether it would be volume, those are legitimate, and municipalities should feel free to be able to do that. It's when they're really going out of their way to shut down speech is when they run into constitutional problems.
All right, one more quick question before we end. One of the questioners asks, and I'm sort of paraphrasing this, is there anything that a petitioner could bring related to the right to petition the government for redress of grievances under the First Amendment, or are they confined to the free exercise clause and the free speech clause?
Yeah, it could depend on the context or circumstances. Here, it really is more of a free speech, free exercise of religion claim. And it's not really the ability to be able to petition your government as much as they are encountering difficulty from the government.
Mm-hmm. I only asked that question because I feel like the right to petition is often forgotten from the First Amendment, but there is a sixth clause. The petition clause. So
almost a forgotten clause, isn't it, Stephen?
Right, exactly. Yeah. All right. I think that about does it. Thank you so much, Nate, for talking with me this hour. That was a very interesting discussion. And best of luck to you and to Mr. Olivier. I will turn it back to Marco.
Thank you.
Well, thank you both for that fantastic discussion and the benefit of your time and expertise today. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I would also like to thank you, our audience, for joining us. We greatly appreciate your participation. For more information on upcoming events, please visit our website or all major social media platforms at FedSoc. On that note, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.